right, the first case we're going to hear this morning is United States v. Watson, and Ms. Hensler, when you're ready, we'll hear from you.
Good morning. Your Honors, at issue in this case are classic Fourth Amendment questions. The government has conceded that Mr. Watson was under arrest, and the record is clear that there was no probable cause to support that arrest. For that reason, Mr. Watson's statements must be suppressed as fruit of the poisonous tree, and the government has failed to meet its burden of showing a break in the causal chain from the illegal arrest to the statements, which is the standard for the admission of the statements in this context. The facts suggesting seizure and arrest are myriad. The police officers stormed into the corner store without a warrant, wearing police uniforms, including bulletproof vests. Mr. Watson and his boss were working in the corner store at the time, lawfully. They instructed Mr. Watson and his boss to sit down in the back of the store and stop working. They closed the corner store. They read them their Miranda rights. They frisked Mr. Watson. 2 hours later, they informed Mr. Watson's boss, Ms. Steele, that she could not leave the store to go pick up her therapeutic foster daughter from school, and they were kept in the same position for 3 hours. So on these facts, it's clear that a reasonable person sitting in Mr. Watson's shoes would not have felt free to leave under these circumstances.
Oh, you clearly wasn't, but the question I would have, I must say, we have a case on Friday this week where that practice is followed, but I've seen it dozens of times where, and they're usually not challenged, where the police enter a house to search it and secure it until they get a warrant. And the normal police practice is to bring everybody in the house to the living room, sit them down, whether they're guilty or not, to secure the place until the search warrant. And that's an administrative type of detention. If the officers let the people go and tried to sort it out, who knows where they would go? Two houses down, get guns, and come back and raid, or give people warnings. And I think it's a normal police practice in just about every case like this, where when they secure the house, they do a sweep, they frisk everybody down, they put the innocent people in a room, watch them until they get the warrant. Now, the question in this case is, there's a three-hour period, which is, it sounds to me, it's pretty long, 3 hours. And you challenge that point, and which I think is legitimate. But I think the detention of the people there is an administrative type of detention. It's like arresting a witness, or it's like preserving the status quo and preserving the safety of the officers. If they went into a house, a stash house, 20 people are in there, and they don't know who's doing what, but they see a lot of drugs, money, and guns. They say, hold it, everybody stay there. We're going to get a warrant. I think it would be really a drastic step if a court were to say they had to let all those people go because they didn't have probable cause to detain them. The normal procedure is to detain everybody until you get the search. And then you do the sorting out, and you either put somebody on arrest or then you let them go. Now, in this case, it's usually an hour and a half or something, but in this case, it was 3 hours, and the court might have been generous to the government because it may have been a little longer. Then you have to ask, was it necessary? Did you need that time? And even if it's necessary, is there a limit? Can you keep them overnight while you're getting a warrant? I mean, what if this happened on Christmas Eve and you couldn't get to an officer until the next day? And so that does raise an issue, but I'm not sure your issue as to whether they have to have cause to detain them while you're waiting for the warrant is a legitimate one. But you can argue it. I'm just telling you what my reaction is about what I think normal police procedure is.
Well, I would like to address the stash house hypothetical that Your Honor presented.
Sure.
This case is distinct from that hypothetical because the police officers who were covertly observing the drug activity outside of the store saw the side entrance of the building used to facilitate the drug activity.
And the front door, too. Jackson came out the front door, you remember?
Only at the end.
Yeah,
and
but he was there. It indicates that this is sort of a single building. You know, he's going in one door, coming out the other door, and it's a connected building. And to fault the officers when everybody has access in and out like this, to fault them for securing the whole building, which has two entrances, that's a hard thing for us to do.
But they didn't just secure the building in this case. They secured, your argument is they secured the person of Mr. Watson as opposed to the building. The question I have for you is, you and the government seem to be ships passing in the night in terms of the legal analysis. You argue that Brown applies. The government argues that MacArthur applies. Why doesn't MacArthur apply in this case to the seizure of Mr. Watson?
Well, MacArthur is an apposite because the seizure in that case was a seizure of property, Mr. MacArthur's home. And the court in MacArthur found that the police had imposed permissible temporary restraints on the citizen's access to his home. But it's interesting that even...
Does that make any sense in the case of normal police practice, as indicated by Judge Niemeyer, that it... I mean, why shouldn't MacArthur apply to this case? And the question I have is whether the district court properly applied MacArthur, particularly the third factor in MacArthur.
The district court should not have applied MacArthur because it does not address seizures of persons. The as your honors have both suggested.
Michigan versus Summers did, though.
But the key fact
is. Cephas did, too.
And Cephas did as well.
8 to 10 people were detained. They weren't culpable.
But as Your Honor pointed out, for the most part, cases do not challenge the illegal detention of the other people. And in Cephas...
But there is no basis. That's the reason. You're not going to find much case law, but you'll find in the facts of case after case, when they raid a house, children, women, girlfriends, they're all detained. And that detention is not a suspicion-based detention. It's an administrative base. It's like arresting witnesses. It's like preserving evidence, assuring safety. It's part of that process. Now, that process has limits, and you're pushing the argument in this case, and I think properly so, as to whether 3 hours is a limit. But I think to tell officers when they're following a procedure for their safety and for the preservation of evidence and to sort it all out and get a warrant to justify the search, to say they should have secured this person and not this person. At that point, they didn't know much about Watson. They frisked him for the safety. They're entitled to do that. And they frisk her. They're entitled to do that, sweep the house, and then say, sit still. And at that point, proceed with the search. Now, in this case, the search would have disclosed Watson's room and the evidence and so forth.
It's the
or did disclose it.
Excuse me, Your Honor. It's the first two things that they did. They frisked Mr. Watson, and they temporarily detained him.
The grandmother.
Which
they can frisk the grandmother. They can frisk the children.
And those things probably would be permissible in light of the Fourth Amendment.
And detain them.
But the third step, detaining him, is not permissible. And the fact
let him go.
Yes, Your Honors, they should
so
have.
He goes next door and alerts the cousin. And the cousin gets the troop in, and he says, there's only three cops in there, let's take them down.
But the difference between this case and the hypothetical posed by Judge Niemeyer, and also Cephas, is that the officers had absolutely no information tying Mr. Watson to any of this illegal activity.
Of course, it's not a suspicion-based detention. It's an administrative detention for safety and preservation of evidence.
Does the fact that they read Mr. Watson his Miranda rights at the time he detained him change this from an administrative detention, as Judge Niemeyer would talk about, to an arrest?
It is one of the factors which converts this from a temporary detention into an arrest.
He's arrested. They're all arrested. Arrested means stop. They were not free to leave, right? No one was free to leave.
That's correct.
And when you, if somebody was standing at the light pole on the corner of the street watching everything going down, and as soon as the cops came, ran, the cops could have arrested that person as a material witness and put him in the house. There's no, that's a detention and it's an arrest.
Supported by probable cause.
No, That guy didn't do anything. He was watching. They want his testimony. Mm-hmm. We arrest people who are ready to leave the country and keep them weeks in order to stay for trial, to testify at trial, then we release them. But our process isn't limited, detention isn't limited to just probable cause. It's a reasonable standard. And the reasonableness is, what about the car stops for driving while intoxicated? No suspicion. Detention, short indeed, but it's a detention. They're not free to go.
Again,
and we've proved that. There's many, many places we approve detentions. Airport security, you're not free to go through there without being frisked, as awful as that is.
Except for the test for whether or not someone is seized is whether or not, standing in their shoes, a reasonable person would feel free to leave or not.
Conceded. Nobody can argue that he wasn't seized. Mm-hmm. Everybody in that house was seized. When you're told you can't leave, you're seized. But that doesn't mean it's illegal.
Well, it does in an instance where the police have absolutely no information tying an individual to any unlawful activity.
That argument suggests that the only reason they can seize him is for probable cause.
What the police officers should have done was what they began to do. They came in, they frisked Mr. Watson, and they should have asked him a few questions, gotten his information, and released him. That would have secured their interests. They would have ensured that he didn't have any weapons that could have threatened them, and they would have ensured that he didn't have any evidence on him that he could have destroyed. And then they should have escorted him to the exit of the store.
And so he goes next door and alerts people. I mean, this practice, if we were to condemn this practice as unconstitutional, we would be standing on its head, one of the biggest factors in police practices. It's when President Lincoln was shot, the police would have been authorized to seal the building if they could have in time. Seal the entire building. Nobody goes. And that wouldn't have been because they suspect everybody in the building. They had no way to tie everybody. It's because it's until they get the search warrants and the look at the building, look for the culprit and so forth, they can do that. That's part of our practice. And I don't know, do you know of a case that says they can't detain innocent people while waiting for a search warrant?
No, Your Honor. It's interesting that there aren't any cases directly on point. But the fact that nobody has challenged this clear practice of the Baltimore City Police Department.
It's been going on since the beginning of the country.
But that still doesn't answer the question of what
your
is...
Your response would be that they hadn't been challenged because they hadn't been charged with a crime.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Well, the thing that's bothering me about your position is that you really haven't factored in the significance, if any, of the Miranda warnings. How does that work into this case?
In two ways, Your Honors. Mm-hmm. Your Honor, first, it demonstrates that it's one of the factors which demonstrates that Mr. Watson and Ms. Steele were under arrest. Two,
they certainly were in police custody.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Two, it also factors into the attenuation argument. Brown v. Illinois, which I believe to be the case which is closest to on all fours as that case can be to these circumstances, clearly sets out black letter law, which is Miranda warnings alone cannot cure the taint of an illegal arrest. And while the government has argued that Miranda warnings here were sufficient to show the purge of that illegal taint, Brown is clear they must show more. And
but if 3 hours... I'm interested in the three-hour period as opposed to the two-hour period that was at issue in MacArthur. What did the record show in this case in terms of where the police had to go to get the warrant, how far away it was? Does the record show that?
No, only that Detective Jameson had to go to Circuit Court Judge Catherine O'Malley and retrieve it, but it's not clear where that happened.
Well, Catherine O'Malley is the governor's wife, so they may have gone down to Annapolis. No, I'm kidding. She did her duty. She had us in office.
Yes, and we have not challenged the search warrant in this case, but what we have challenged...
No, but I'm talking about the reasonableness of the length of the period of detention. I mean, if they had to go two blocks, it arguably would be different from traveling 20 miles.
That's correct, Your Honor. After 3 hours, any reasonable person in Mr. Watson's shoes would have could have thought that they were under arrest and they were to be detained indefinitely, and that the event that occurred, which is of real significance here,
did they tell him he was under arrest?
No.
I didn't think so. I think it's a little bit like the Miranda warning. I think is actually gratuitous and probably useful, because if you collected, let's say, the grandmother and the three daughters and a girlfriend and some children, put them on the sofa in the living room and told them, look, everybody keep quiet, don't say anything. Incidentally, anything you say can be used against you. If I were them, I'd be quiet. But they weren't under arrest in the sense that they were being charged with a crime. And I don't think he was told that he was being charged with a crime until they found the stuff in his room.
But that's not required for a seizure of a person.
I'm just saying that I think, personally, I think, and I'm not speaking with my colleagues here, but I think it is just routine practice to detain people in that circumstance. And not because they're culpable, but because the process of effecting the search and getting the search warrant requires some kind of order, and that's part of that order, is to detain everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had to let everybody go, they'd be letting evidence go, they'd be letting witnesses go, they'd be letting culpable persons go.
Ms. Hensler, let's assume for a minute that we disagree with you on the on your main premise. Why don't we have a harmless error case here, at least? Because you have those two independent witnesses indicating that the front room was the room in which the defendant resided. The gun was found in a closet. It was in a private place. It wasn't like it was open on a bed where anybody could have gotten easily in and out. Why isn't that a case where, aside from the defendant's statements, the case was made against him?
This was a constructive possession case. Mm-hmm. The gun was found in a bag near the closet in the room that was identified as Mr. Watson's. His room was open and accessible to anyone, whereas Mr. Jackson's room, who was the individual they saw participating in the drug activity outside, his room was locked. The bag was lying on its side. And again, this is a constructive possession case, and these statements are the only things that demonstrate knowledge by Mr. Watson of the gun. And it's clear that the two witnesses that testified would not have testified at trial had we prevailed on the suppression issue. But more than that, the jury notes themselves demonstrate that this was the crucial fact that the jury considered in their deliberations. Three jury notes address the issue of the statement over a period of 12 hours. And if your honors would refer to the final note included in the supplemental joint appendix, it's written in very emphatic, all caps, handwriting with underlining, please read us this statement. And a half hour later, after the judge read them the statement they requested, which again were the statements elicited by Detective Jameson during this illegal arrest, they rendered a guilty verdict.
Okay, so but you do agree that the evidence did establish independently that that was his room?
Well, Your Honor, one of the...
So you're just talking about the knowledge, the defendant's guilty knowledge, essentially, of the location of the gun.
The evidence at trial, but again, the evidence at trial, these two witnesses proffered by the defense, were proffered only after we did not prevail on the suppression issue. So obviously the defense would have taken a different tactic. They found paperwork in Mr. Watson's name in this room. Mm-hmm. And indeed, one of the statements that he gave during the course of this arrest was, that's my room. So again, in suppressing the statements that were the fruit of this illegal arrest, you would undermine the government's case significantly. They would basically have the paperwork and any other witnesses they would proffer to the fact that he was living there. But again, it was a constructive possession case that hinged very clearly on the statement. So it cannot be considered harmless error.
Okay, you have some rebuttal time. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Mr. Mason.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christopher Mason. I represent the United States in this case. I'll get right to what I believe is the crux of the matter as identified by Judge Niemeyer, and that this three-hour period between the time that the officers entered the residence to the time that they came back with the warrant was not...
It may even be a generous finding. The district court, I don't know if it's clearly erroneous, but the district court found 3 hours.
Yes, he did. Fact. That's correct.
But if I were to posit a hypothetical to you that it, instead of 3 hours, it was overnight, maybe 18 hours, does there come a point when the administrative process of detaining people to get the search warrant pushes the limits of reasonableness?
I think there probably does come a point when...
Regardless of how hard the government tried. In other words, there are times when it's hard to find the judicial officer, usually there is always somebody on duty, but oftentimes it's hard. Now, in this case, 3 hours, you don't see that amount normally. It may be near the limits. I raise that question because I think it's a very legitimate question for the defendant to raise in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. I think what the evidence presented during the motions hearing by the government was that it was somewhere around 2, 2.5 hours when the motions hearing continued on the second day. The defense presented evidence that it was somewhere around closer to 4 hours, and I think that's...
Mrs. Steele said that.
Correct. And I think Judge Bennett essentially took the median of the two and said, I'm going to find that it was probably somewhere closer to 3 hours. So that, in this case, I think is where the government came from and where the defense came from in terms of the length of period that Mr. Watson was detained. However, there is evidence in the record that the officers didn't take this, and I'm not even going to call it an extended period of time, but didn't take this 3 hours in order to make Mr. Watson feel uncomfortable or in order to try and get some type of statement out of him while they were just off acting like they were getting a search and seizure warrant. Detective Jameson did testify at one point that he left the scene after his initial arrest. He arrested an individual who he observed, or who Deputy Major D'Souza observed, engaged in hand-to-hand narcotics transactions. After arresting that individual, that's when Detective Jameson went to begin writing the warrant. He also testified that while he was writing that warrant, Deputy Major D'Souza called him again and gave him the update that they had just arrested Mr. Jackson and that he didn't have a gun on him. And that I believe Deputy Major D'Souza wanted that information in the warrant as well.
The district court found that this was an arrest. The district court plainly makes that statement.
Yes.
But what I don't see on this record, and what I'd like you to tell me on this record, is where do the police, under the third factor in MacArthur, make reasonable efforts to reconcile their law enforcement needs with the demands of personal privacy? They hold this man for 3 hours, and he can't leave, Steele can't leave, and where is it that on this record that the district court paid any attention at all to the third factor in MacArthur?
I think at one point in his decision, Judge Bennett did indicate that he did not think that it was the three-hour period was a lengthy period of time. So I think that's where we have to fall back in terms of that third factor and the reasonable efforts to reconcile law enforcement needs with the demands for personal privacy. The officers went in there, as Judge Niemeyer indicated. It was obviously reasonable for them to enter that house and to detain these two individuals while Detective Jameson obtained the search and seizure warrant.
Doesn't the record have to show that their efforts were reasonable? In other words, that it took them time to get this warrant for certain reasons, that the judge wasn't available, that perhaps they had to confer with other police officers in another case in order to draw up a warrant that was consistent. What really bothers me about the government's case here is that there has apparently no real attempt to show why the government's three-hour detention was reasonable in this case. It could well be that it was reasonable if, you know, there were law enforcement needs that required it. But when we don't know, and all we know is that this man was held for 3 hours, how can we say that reasonable efforts were made to reconcile the law enforcement needs?
And there's no district court finding on the reasonableness of the efforts at all. The district court just The district court just goes right past it, mm-hmm. and doesn't apply the third factor in MacArthur at all.
Well, I think we have to go back again, as I was indicating before, to Detective Jameson's testimony, in that he went to get the warrant at one point, which is after he made that arrest. He had to go back, and I believe his testimony was he had to go back to the district, which is where he wrote the arrest warrant. There's nothing in the record, obviously, to indicate how far the district was from where this was taking place. It's not in the record. I could tell Your Honors how far away it is, because obviously I know, and I'm not going to do that. But
it doesn't do us a lot of good.
Right. But he indicated once he got back there and began writing the warrant, he got another call from Deputy Major D'Souza giving him more information to include in that warrant. So he also then had to go back and include that information and then go to the district judge. Again, there's nothing in the record to indicate how far the district, the police district, is from the district court. Again, I know that from my personal practice.
Should we find as a matter of law that 3 hours is a reasonable period of time?
I think Your Honors can find that. I don't believe that 3 hours in MacArthur, it was 2 hours. I'm not sure there's ever a finding in Michigan v. Summers as to how long that detention was, but that, again, it was the same type of...
I thought it was 2 hours in Michigan versus...
2 hours in Michigan.
The issue here is, they get the warrant at some point. So the statements are made after the warrant is issued. So one could look at this case as Michigan versus Summers after the 3 hours. The issue is really the 3 hours, mm-hmm. and what happened during that period. And one of the factors to be considered is, what's the nature of the police conduct? Well, they don't bother him at all during those 3 hour period. The only issue is they hold him for 3 hours.
Correct.
They don't question him. They don't do anything to him. He just sits there for 3 hours.
That's correct. There's nothing in the record to indicate that they ever talked to Mr. Watson, at least questioning him about any type of activity that went on inside the house.
The question takes place after the warrant is issued.
Yes.
So one could look at it as a Michigan versus Summers case at the end of the 3 hours, but the question is, what do those 3 hours do to the calculus? And if the seizure of the person is illegal, and there's a taint, and I have some question about that, but if there is there anything here from your perspective under Wong's son that breaks the causal connection?
In this, I believe there is. Once the officers, obviously, initially when they go in, they Mirandize Mr. Watson and Ms. Steele. They sit there for 3 hours. There's no indication that they ask them any questions. I know at one point they allow Ms. Steele to make a phone call so she can try and get someone to pick up her foster daughter, I believe it is. Then when the warrant comes...
They don't let her
go. No, they do not let her go. Absolutely not. And they don't let anybody... And I'm not going to stand up here, obviously, and tell Your Honors that this isn't some type of seizure. Clearly it is. None of them are free to leave. I'm sure Ms. Steele asked to leave, and she wasn't allowed to leave. However, when Detective Jameson
Your
gets...
Your brief spent a lot of time on probable cause and the linkage and all this, which is unfortunate because I think it misdirected the argument. If you substitute, in lieu of Mr. Watson, a grandmother who didn't know anything's going on, and she's detained during that period, told, just keep silent, don't say anything, and we're getting a search warrant. The question then comes, can you keep the grandmother there 3 hours while they get the search warrant? And your answer has to be yes. That's what was necessary in this case. There's no indication of delay. They had to write it up, and they had to go downtown to Judge O'Malley and get it and get it back out. And 2 hours has been approved fairly routinely, and 3 hours is, your argument has to be, isn't that much of a deviation from that.
Correct.
But it seems to me the question, there could be some interesting questions in connection with this, the court's finding on the 3 hours. The court did address 3 hours and didn't come to grips. It sort of noted that MacArthur had 2 hours and
right.
That this wasn't unreasonable. But I must say, if you put into that group of people detained somebody who is clearly not implicated, like a sister or a grandmother who just didn't have any involvement, mm-hmm. and put the detention to the test, the only thing that seems to stick out is how long can we keep somebody. And I'm sure there's got to be some limits. I'm not sure it was reached in this case, but it seems to me that the police don't have complete luxury in this area. They have a luxury to carry out this raid, to get the search warrant, which is to comply with the Constitution, and to follow up from that. But as Judge Urbanski asks, you know, we don't have much case law for 3 hours.
And I agree with Your Honor that obviously there is some limit to how long the officers could keep someone while they're waiting for a warrant to come back.
And my concern in this case is the evidence and the record. That's my concern in this case. What did the government put on at the suppression hearing as to the reasonableness under the third MacArthur factor? Mm-hmm. The district court on page 209 of the appendix says, and this is it, furthermore, the police made reasonable efforts to reconcile their law enforcement needs with the demands of personal privacy. Okay? That pays lip service to the third factor in MacArthur. But where's the evidence that gives the court the ability to make that finding?
I think it has to come from the fact that they Mirandized Mr. Watson. They, while having him there, there's no evidence in the record that shows that they, you know, forced him to make any statement
right,
while he was there.
Really not, I don't think that's Judge Urbanski's point. It's the reasonableness of the police efforts. If we're going to be judging the three-hour period, and whether it's reasonable, we have to know why 3 hours was necessary, don't we?
Yes.
And this record doesn't tell us why 3 hours was necessary.
Well, if we go back to just the...
What in the record, and I don't mean to cut you off, but if you could just answer that directly, what in the record, if you were writing the opinion of this court, what would you put in there that the record shows supports the finding that 3 hours was necessary?
I think if we started from just the very beginning of the testimony of the motions hearing, where Deputy Major D'Souza and Detective Jameson both testified that these observations of this drug activity started at 11 a.m., at approximately 11 a.m., and didn't end until they entered that house at approximately, I think it was 1:45 p.m., and during that entire time, numerous arrests are made. There are many observations of drug activity, so Detective Jameson needs to take the time to go back to the district to write this warrant. And he needs to include all the observations that were seen during this three-hour period. So this is not a warrant that he can just go back and, you know, write out in a short amount of time.
Did find that the search was conducted at 3:45. They got the warrant back at 3:45.
Correct.
And then 2 pages later, it says the government claims that the initial surveillance began at 11:30, and the building wasn't entered till approximately 1:15. And so if we accept those factual findings, 1:15 is when they entered building, and they secured it, and then got a warrant, and they did the search at 3:45.
So that's two and a half hours. Well,
district
court found 3 hours. Correct.
Yeah. And he really sort of split the difference between the government's position and Ms. Steele's testimony of 4 hours.
That's correct.
Okay.
But in terms of reconciling their needs with demands for personal privacy, I think I have to go back to the fact that 3 hours isn't an inordinate amount of time.
See, the thing that's bothering me about this is it's just so easy for the government to do. All they have to do is ask the police officer to state, you know, and a law enforcement wouldn't be impeded in its need to protect people, to protect themselves from ambush and everything else if they could just state on the record, you know, we needed this time because it's easy. So I'm just worried that where is the institutional safeguard if we don't require some showing on the record of reasonableness?
I understand. And I do believe at one point Detective Jameson is testifying, I believe on cross-examination, about when Mr. Watson or Ms. Steele would ever be allowed to leave. And he says, we go in there and we secure the residence. We make sure, you know, there's nobody hiding anywhere, that there are, you know, no weapons anywhere. And I believe at one point he's asked, and then at that point, would they be free to leave? And he says, you know, no, absolutely not. We need to make sure everybody stays in that house and doesn't go anywhere for our safety.
You know, Judge Niemeyer's comments about normal police practice are right on the money and the need to protect the officers and all that. But the concern I have with this case is the proof that the government established as to whether or not there were reasonable efforts to balance Mr. Watson's interest and the government's interest. And on this record, I don't see anything in the evidence that that goes to that balance. That's what's bothering me. Mm-hmm. It's the proof. It's the evidence. It's did the government do its job to prove that this period of time was reasonable? That's what is troubling me.
Understood. The only thing I could say to that, obviously, is it's only one of the three MacArthur factors. One of the four MacArthur factors. The other is that there's probable cause that the house contains contraband in the house or the evidence of a crime. Obviously,
I think there's no question about that. I mean, they see the guy going in at the back stairway, and they're concerned about a gun. You know, right. They think that he may have a gun on him.
Well, proof of the pudding is the state judge issued a warrant and can only do it on probable cause. So,
right.
I think that really isn't troubling.
But does the issuance of the warrant go back and justify the three-hour detention? And you know, Brown says the Miranda warnings don't do it. That doesn't cure the Fourth Amendment violation.
No, that in and of itself, Miranda warnings does not. But I think we can look at just the overall voluntariness afterwards of Mr. Watson's statement. You know, there's testimony all throughout the record that he was never coerced or never forced to make any statements. He was never promised that, you know, Ms. Steele wouldn't be arrested if he made a statement owning up to the gun.
Let me ask you to switch gears for a minute to your harmless error argument. Ms. Hensler says it doesn't work because it's a constructive possession case. And the only thing that shows the guilty knowledge is the defendant's statement regarding the gun not working, acknowledging knowledge of the gun.
Correct.
How do you respond to that?
Obviously, I don't believe that's true. I think the fact that...
How do you build a case of constructive possession based on the evidence in this record on the element of knowledge? I agree with you. The gun's in the room. His papers are in the room. It's mm-hmm. his room.
Correct.
But how do you get the guilty knowledge component necessary?
I think the two defense witnesses that testify, both Ms. Steele and the other individual, I'm sorry, her name escapes me at this point, but the fact that the one individual is actually Mr. Watson's girlfriend, and she had testified that she's, you know, been in his room before, that everything, and I think one of the most important parts of her testimony is that on cross-examination, either myself or Mr. Call asked her, essentially went through this picture of Mr. Watson's room and said, does this belong to him? Does this belong to him? Does this belong to him? And her answer to all that was yes, 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 yes. And then all of a sudden, you know, they asked the jury to believe that, well, everything in that room is his except for the shaving cream bag that obviously has the gun and the ammunition in it. So the most damning evidence that the government had. So I think the fact that the jury asked questions concerning Mr. Watson's statement, I understand there were
a couple of questions.
But I think the reason that they asked a couple of questions is because I think the first two answers weren't responsive. Weren't responsive enough for them, I should say. I think they wanted to really hear a specific part of the transcript. And
the trial court reads it back to them.
Correct. And I think the first time it gets read back, that's not what they wanted to hear. I think they didn't hear the part that they wanted. And I think that's why the second question came out. So I think the reliance on the fact that there were two or three questions asked about Mr. Watson's statement is kind of a little bit overblown, because I think those questions were asked because they weren't getting the answer that they were actually looking for when they were asking those questions.
But given the fact that they're interested, how can this be harmless error? I mean, the only thing we know about what the jury was thinking about are the questions they send out.
That's correct. But we also don't know how many people were asking those questions. It could have been one juror. And if that's the case, then I believe it would be harmless error. I mean, we have the evidence that front room is Mr. Watson's by two defense witnesses, not necessarily, like, just taking out the fact that his statement, that he indicated that his room was
that
his.
That answer can't possibly hold up. That if it's only one juror, it doesn't make much difference, because that's all it takes, isn't it?
That's correct. That is correct.
And I go back to a question of what I'm trying to figure out what inherently was necessary in this case to get the warrant. 2700 Tivoli Avenue, how far is that from downtown Baltimore?
Obviously, is it okay if I continue? Am I related?
It's okay, you can continue, and this is something that we can verify also by judicial looking at a map, but I just want to
correct.
Know from your...
2700 Tivoli Avenue is, I'd say...
Where is it located?
It is in northeast Baltimore City. It's on the corner of Harford Road, and the actual 2700 Tivoli is just about on the corner of Harford Road and Tivoli Avenue. It is about, I'd say, a couple miles from the Northeast District, which is where I believe Detective Jameson went back to actually write the warrant, and it is a couple miles from the East Side District Court, which is, I believe, now I'm not positive about this, but I believe where Detective Jameson probably went to get the warrant signed by Judge O'Malley.
This is all within the city of Baltimore?
Yes. Yes. One, the district is north of
so
2700 Tivoli.
The process would be to go from the house to the station to write it up.
That's correct.
And then after it's written up, to go to the judge.
That's correct.
Get the judge's time to have her sign it. And then go back. And it looks to me on the record, the judge gave 3 hours, but it looks to me that we do have pretty hard evidence that they didn't even enter the house until 11:15, and that the warrant was actually returned at 3:45.
I believe that's true, yes. And obviously we have to, we can't assume that once the
that's
detective...
That's all documented, and they also have dispatch calls on this thing.
Correct. And once the detective gets to the courthouse, he obviously has to wait for Judge O'Malley to become available.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Hensler. Does that sound right to you, my last questions about the geographical issues?
I actually drove that route, not to the Northeast Police Precinct, but from 2700 Tivoli Avenue to downtown Baltimore recently, and it took me 15 minutes.
That's pretty good traffic. I drive in Baltimore City.
it was a Sunday morning, admittedly.
Oh,
but
everybody was in church.
But Your Honors had honed in on something which is important, which is there's a lack of evidence in the record that this period of time was reasonable, and
I don't know on the Supreme Court standard. Whether we have to find actually the steps that were followed and whether the police were expeditious, it looks to me like they look in the gross sense and measure, for instance, 3 days, they would say, regardless of how hard it was, they would probably say 3 days is just too long. You just can't detain people like that. Where they have said 2 hours is not a problem. Now, here, we have something in excess of 2 hours, but we also have the need to type it up, and we just know the pragmatics of it. You have to go and type it up. You have to get an affidavit, sign the affidavit, and then you have to take it down and find the judge and get the judge to look at it and then go back and serve it and drive the whole thing. If you look at it from that point of view, the necessity may be established, but I'm not sure that's the ultimate standard necessary to get the warrant, the reasonable necessary to get the warrant. But I'm wondering that somewhere two and a half to 3 hours is such a step beyond what would be required in every case to get a warrant. I mean, warrants, they don't carry pre-typed warrants. They have to go type it up and look at their notes and do their facts. It might be a pretty difficult rule to apply in all cases to say, once you get to 3 hours, you're dead. The warrant's no good anymore. I mean, the detention's no good anymore.
Your Honor, I don't believe the record is clear that they didn't begin typing up the warrant until this warrantless entry of the building, which occurred at some point between noon and 1:15. Obviously, Ms. Steele testified that it was before noon. They should have begun that process earlier. This period of time, 3 to 4 hours, demonstrates that this third factor, that law enforcement needs were tailored to personal privacy interests. That factor is not met in this case.
So you're saying it's an assumption that the police began writing the warrant after they secured the building. We don't know.
That's correct. And Detective Jameson,
except we know who wrote the warrant, and we know that he had to leave that scene to go to his place. And we know he was at the scene at that period.
Except for there is testimony which suggests that the officers began executing arrests at 11:30. Detective Jameson.
Well, I know, but I'm talking about mm-hmm. who actually prepared the warrant. Mm-hmm. Where was he at 1:00?
In the Northeast Precinct. He was not part of the SWAT team that entered the building at between noon and 1. So he should have already been well into his affidavit in support of the search warrant at that point. But the problem is we don't know on this record. We don't know.
The question is, do we have any case that says we have to take the steps through, or can we conclude that in the context where we have an urban environment and you have to go to the police station to get your gear, and then you have to go downtown and then come back. Can we take that into account and assume that there is some reasonable necessity? Then the question still remains in the big picture, is it detention in this context of 2.5 to 3 hours unconstitutional, administratively beyond what could be considered reasonable, because the district judge found it reasonable. So it, anyway, we understand. I appreciate your arguments. Anything further?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then proceed on to the next case.